Welcome to the America's Workforce Radio Podcast, the flagship production of the American Workers Radio and Podcast Network, where organized labor and its never-ending fight to protect the rights of the American worker come first. Now, presented by LIUNA, Laborers International Union of North America, here's your host, Ed Flash Ferens.
It's Thanksgiving Day. A message from the AFL-CIO on Strikesgiving. And on the show today, the Government Affairs Director of the Labor Federation and the Labor's talk wage theft. Welcome to the Thursday, November 25th edition of America's Workforce, where we are available on six platforms. That includes Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Pandora, and the platform known as Stitcher. We have two guests on the show today. This is Thanksgiving Day, and no stranger to being on the show on Thanksgiving Day is Mr. Bill Samuel, Government Affairs Director of the Labor Federation. He always joins us on the fourth Thursday. And one of the topics we're going to get into, especially in the first segment, is the Build Back Better deal. Now, this is the legislation which passed in the House about a week ago with no Republican support. And this is legislation that would complement the infrastructure deal, which has bipartisan support. And Bill is going to zero in on what's in the bill now, what was taken out of the bill, and what he sees ahead. And he is of the opinion, like others, that we'll probably see some passage on this around Christmas time. So he's going to dissect that. And in the second segment, we're going to get into voting rights and filibuster reform. And right now, because of the narrow majority, the Democrats have the House, the Senate, and obviously the White House, but they don't have a mandate. And as a result, it's very, very difficult to get things done in the Senate. You need a majority there, and they don't have it. They don't have it. Well, with Kamala Harris dealing with certain legislation, yeah, you got the 51, but in many cases, due to the filibuster, you need 60 votes. And that's an issue that's been a sore spot for a long time now. So Bill's going to be our first guest. He'll talk about that. Lucas Franco will be joining us later in the show. And Lucas is with our presenting sponsor. That would be Laborers International Union of North America. He is the regional research manager for the state of Minnesota and North Dakota. LIUNA members work in a wide array of infrastructure construction work. We're talking anything from pipeline construction, coal plant maintenance, wind farm production. And Lucas, I'll tell you, he's a bright spot. He holds a PhD in political science from the University of Minnesota, a master's from the University of Oslo in Norway, got his bachelor's from Seattle University. We are going to talk about wage theft, which is a huge problem, especially in his area, the Minnesota construction industry. And there's some data on that, courtesy of the Midwest Economic Policy Institute. An estimated, this is mind-blowing, one in four workers in Minnesota are victims of wage theft, which is equal to about 30,100 construction workers. I'll tell you, the workers are getting ripped off and the states are getting ripped off because they're not getting the tax revenue. So that's primarily what we're going to talk about with Lucas Franco as our second guest right here on America's Workforce. And that website, by the way, is liunaminnesota.org, liunaminnesota.org. Well, you thought Striketober was over? Not at all. Worker uprisings have more momentum than ever. And this is courtesy of the Labor Federation. If you go to AFLCIO.org, they have a strike map there. And you can see where all the strikes are happening in America. Mine workers in Alabama, student workers at Columbia University, cereal workers at Kellogg's factories around the country. Just a few of the strikes happening right now. And the Labor Federation points out, we are in the middle of a historic worker uprising. So take this. Again, that's AFLCIO.org. Quick break. When we come back, Bill Samuel of the AFL-CIO.
This is America's Workforce.
It takes LIUNA to build North America's infrastructure. From roads and bridges to schools and skyscrapers, the men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, build the projects we depend on. From constructing the Freedom Tower on the site of the former World Trade Center to untangling Washington, D.C.'s congested interstate, LIUNA members do the work that matters. Find out what it takes to be built by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
America's workforce is being brought to you in part by the Communication Workers of America.
From the Golden Gate Bridge to the St. Louis Gateway Arch, the Sears Tower, and just about every building, bridge, and structure in between, our cities and towns wouldn't be the same without iron workers. With over 3,000 contractors employing more than 130,000 highly trained iron workers and 20,000 apprentices, the Iron Workers Union stands ready and able to shape the future of our skylines. Learn more at ironworkers.org. Iron Workers, the sky's the limit.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
Hey, don't forget, you can check us out on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Twitter handle, real simple, AWF Union Podcast. AWF Union Podcast. By the way, this next segment brought to you in part by the North Coast Area Labor Federation, all connected to the AFL-CIO, AFLCIO.org. Speaking of which, let's go to line number one. Welcome one of our regulars. It seems every Thanksgiving Day, we're talking to this guy, and that would be Mr. Bill Samuel, Government Affairs Director for the Labor Federation. Hey, Bill, welcome back. Happy Thanksgiving to you, buddy.
Thank you, and happy Thanksgiving to you.
Very good. Very good. I'm sure everybody has their complete list of union-made turkeys, Butterball for one, by the food and commercial workers. And for more information on that, just go to Labor411. Because we got so many holidays in front of us, you want to make sure you're supporting union brothers and sisters the best you can. Let's talk about the Build Back Better deal, and that passed the House last week. We still got to get some confirmation in the Senate. So last time you and I spoke, in fact, I don't even think the basic infrastructure legislation that Biden signed into law was passed. Let's start there. I mean, let's start from the beginning here, because that's been talked about and that does have bipartisan support. But what are you hearing about that as far as implementation, Bill?
Well, yeah, let's kind of start at the beginning. The president's Build Back Better agenda, which originally was $6 trillion. It was sort of whittled back when it got to Congress. Last summer, ended up being split in two. A number of moderate Democrats and Republicans said, let's take the infrastructure portion of the Build Back Better agenda out and deal with that separately. So that became the Infrastructure and Investment Act, and that passed about 3 weeks ago and was signed into law on the White House lawn in a ceremony last week. And that's the basic infrastructure that, you know, is clearly the responsibility of the federal government working with states. But this is much bigger than usual. So this is over $1 trillion, $500 billion in new money. So these are new projects that were not, you know, contemplated the last time Congress looked at infrastructure. And this is everything from, you know, roads and bridges to broadband. They want to connect 100% of the population to high-speed internet. They want to replace every lead pipe in every community, and they want to set up a nationwide system of electric vehicle charging stations. That's all paid for under this Infrastructure and Investment Act, again, signed by the president last Monday. So what's left of the Build Back Better agenda is now what's called the Build Back Better Act. And it's the more of the human infrastructure, education, healthcare, preschool for all 3 and 4 year olds, expansion of Medicare. It's got some labor enforcement provisions in there. That's about also about one. Well, this is $1.7 trillion. So all told, we're talking about, you know, $2.5 trillion in spending. This Build Back Better Act should. It did pass the House, as you said, at the end of last week. Should pass the Senate by Christmas and will be on the president's desk as a great, fantastic Christmas present to the American people.
Now, Bill, wasn't this originally like $6 trillion, something like that figure? And I'm hearing it's below $2 trillion now. Am I accurate?
Right.
In that?
Well, Well, together they were about $6 trillion. So the infrastructure bill, which again kind of got pulled out of it this summer when the moderate Republicans and Democrats got together and ended up passing on a bipartisan basis, that's a little over $1 trillion. And then the Build Back Better Act, which is the remainder, is almost $2 trillion. So it's about half as big as the president's original proposal. You know, when you add it up, it's a little over $3 trillion. Still very significant. When you think back to the Obama administration, when we were dealing with the recession, the meltdown on Wall Street, the financial crisis, to pull ourselves out of that, the government passed what at the time was considered a very big stimulus package, and it was about $800 billion. We're now talking about close to $3 trillion. And by the way, last March, we passed the American Rescue Plan to deal with the COVID crisis. That was over almost $2 trillion. So we are talking actually about nearly $5 trillion in federal spending, all for good causes. A lot of it, most of it is paid for by raising taxes on big corporations and the wealthy who've been, you know, getting off scot-free for all these years. You know, all the billionaires and big corporations that don't pay any taxes are going to start paying taxes under this bill, and it's going to pay for these very necessary projects.
So are you saying it's closing some of the loopholes then, or is it actually going to add to those that can mostly afford higher taxes? Is that what might be happening here?
Right. Well, no one who earns under $400,000, which I imagine is most of your listeners, is going to have any additional tax bill as a result of this. In fact, they may pay less in taxes, particularly if they have kids, because of the child tax credit, which will be extended for another year. But no, this is to close loopholes that have allowed corporations to write off so much that they don't end up owing anything, and wealthy individuals who, again, exploit loopholes in the system, there'll be a minimum tax. So no matter how many deductions you claim, if you're Exxon or Amazon or Google, you're still going to pay a minimum tax of 15%, assuming you made money last year, which they all do. And it is going to raise taxes on millionaires. If you have $25 million a year in income, you're going to pay an extra 3% in taxes, that kind of thing. So it's going after the right people, the right corporations, not ordinary Americans. They're not going to see any increase in their taxes.
Now, talk to me about what was taken out of the legislation. As you know, this was pricier than it is now, and it may even go lower. I don't know, but can we get into some of the details on what will not be in the Build Back Better bill?
Yeah, I mean, one thing that was dropped out, unfortunately, when the price tag came down was 2 years of free community college. So that was a big ticket item. Expanding Medicare to pay for it. Dental and vision. Right now, it's only going to pay for hearing aids. There are some across-the-board cutbacks. For example, the child tax credit will only be extended for a year instead of through 2025. So that saved a bunch of money. So there was, you know, a lot of programs are going to get a little bit less, or they're going to get the same amount for a shorter period of time. A couple of programs were cut out altogether, as I said, free community college, some of the Medicare expansions. I think school construction, I believe, was dropped out of this bill. Hopefully will be picked up in another one later next year. So it is, you know, we're disappointed in the in what was lost. Paid family leave is in the bill, but only 4 weeks. It was 12 weeks. So that's how they achieved these savings. And this was mostly at the insistence of Senator Joe Manchin from West Virginia, Kyrsten Sinema, who didn't want to raise certain taxes. That brought the total cost or money available down, and then they had to make these cuts. So disappointment, but we really should focus on what's in it. It's still a transformational piece of legislation.
Yeah. So we had 12 weeks of paid family leave, and 8 weeks was taken out, so we're down to 4. Hopefully that's not going to be chopped down
exactly.
any further.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep. Yep.
What about, you mentioned the labor provisions, and I really want to zero in on that, because from the way this process has been going, we're talking kind of like the protect the right to organize stuff, where, you know, certain penalties would be increased.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I think some of the people working on the bill were trying to include those in this legislation.
So far, I mean, as the bill passed the House, so this is what's going over to the Senate, there are, for the first of financial penalties for companies that violate the right to organize and bargain. So as you all know and your listeners know, there are no financial penalties in the National Labor Relations Act. There haven't been since 1935. This would, for the first time, impose financial penalties on companies who are guilty of committing unfair labor practices. $50,000 per violation, up to $100,000 if the company is particularly large and has a pattern of committing these violations. And the fines can be assessed against individual corporate executives. So both of those things are new. They're not currently available to unions who are trying to organize and bargain. That, we think that's a game changer. To actually penalize companies for violating the law. Now, that's the House passed that. It's before the Senate right now. The one hitch is that the Senate parliamentarian gets to decide what stays in the bill and what comes out based on Senate rules. We hope she'll leave this in. If it is in, according to the parliamentarian, if it's appropriate for this bill, for the special treatment this bill gets. Remember, this bill can't be filibustered because it's a budget. It's a budget reconciliation bill. And that's why she gets to decide what fits in a budget reconciliation bill. We think these penalties are appropriate because they raise money, and that means it has an impact on the budget and should stay.
Mm-hmm.
If it is, we think it'll become the law of the land when the president signs this bill, which is it's an important component of the Protecting the Right to Organize Act.
Oh, boy, that'd be great. Okay, you've been working this for a long time, Bill. I'm going to ask you, what's your gut telling you about this Senate parliamentarian? Now, this is one person that obviously has a whole lot of power.
Oh, my gosh.
Talk to me about that.
Yeah, she's one person. She's not elected. She's appointed by the majority leader, but she tends to be in whether Republicans or Democrats are in the majority. They try not to, fire the parliamentarian of the previous party so that they can claim that they're sort of objective, not
uh-huh.
partisan. So this parliamentarian has been there for some time. I think we have a good chance. There's precedent for this kind of provision being in a budget reconciliation bill. By the way, in addition to the penalties for ULPs, they are also increasing by tenfold financial fines, civil monetary penalties, they're called, for OSHA violations and violations of the Fair Labor Standards Act. So there already are financial penalties for violations of those two laws. They're small, and this would multiply them by 10. So a $1,000 mm-hmm. fine becomes a $10,000 fine under OSHA and the Fair Labor Standards Act. We think it's almost a certainty that will stay in because there's a lot of precedent for increasing penalties that already exist. The National Labor Relations Act is a little iffier because there aren't financial penalties in the law right now. We're putting them in this budget reconciliation bill. But I think we have a better than 50-50 chance of surviving.
And, the good companies have nothing to worry about. I mean, if they're going to play, by the rules of safety, they're fine. And they're fine. But if you're going to violate workers' health, and you know how many unsafe working places there are in America, Bill, I mean, they should be fine. They should be jailed when you think about it, right?
They absolutely should be. The problem is when there are no meaningful penalties, there's companies will ignore the mandate of the law. They've been doing it for years, certainly with regard to the right to organize, if not safety and health and Fair Labor Standards Act violations. It's basically a law without any teeth. And this puts teeth in the National Labor Relations Act for the first time. And we think it'll have real consequences. We think employers are going to think twice before they, drag workers, over the coals who are trying to do the, take advantage of their basic right to organize a union. That's supposed to be protected, but it's not because there's no sanction for companies that violate it.
Man, we'll see what happens here. So you're still feeling that probably by Christmas time we might see some legislation regarding Build Back Better then. You feel pretty good about
it? Yes,
we think,
the House, as I said, the House has passed it. The Senate will have it before it when they come back from this week off, this Thanksgiving break. And they've got 4 weeks in December to finish it up, get through the parliamentarian, pass it, and then send it on to the president.
Bill, one more question here before we break. The first part of this, the infrastructure legislation, the $1.2 trillion that we're talking about, that includes so many parts, broadband, our waterways, our bridges. Is that going to happen right away? Is it already happening? What do we know about that right now?
Well, I think it's going to depend. You know, the money has been approved, so it can be spent, you know, right away as we speak. Now, you know, for localities to take advantage of it, they've got to have plans, they've got to be approved, and then they got to start hiring people. That takes time, obviously. You don't build a bridge, you know, in a week. You've got to have all kinds of, you know, siting requirements, impact statements, approval of local zoning entities. So that'll all have to happen first. But I think it'll be quicker. There are projects that are kind of on the books waiting to start, and those could start this spring, you know, in the construction season. We're obviously heading into winter in a lot of the country, so there may be delays just because of weather. But I think the work on expanding broadband and this all these pipes that are going to be replaced, we should see that's beginning in the spring this year, or I should say next year, 2022.
Yeah. There's not too much time left this year, but that's all good news.
Right. There's only four weeks.
one thing is for sure. We've been talking a lot. You know, last week was National Apprenticeship Week, and we were doing a number of shows, and all the trades are saying, come on down. And there's some jobs available. There's a lot of jobs available. We need you to get involved in these apprenticeship programs. And hopefully, when people start seeing the work that's going to be created, I mean, Biden was talking about like 2 million jobs at least with the with the infrastructure part. I mean, that's a lot when you spread it around in America. So all good news, all good news. Bill Samuel joining us on our live line, Government Affairs Director of the Labor Federation. Lucas Franco on behalf of LIUNA out in Minnesota and North Dakota. He'll be joining us later in the program. Back in a few minutes.
You're listening to America's Workforce with Ed Flash Ferens.
It takes LIUNA to power North America with affordable energy. The men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, have the skills needed to build and maintain oil, natural gas, nuclear, solar, and wind projects that are shaping America's energy future. From new energy tech to retrofitted facilities, LIUNA members do it all. Find out what it takes to be powered by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
Nurses, doctors, and caregivers at the VA are under attack. They face hostile management, callous agency heads, and an administration that's stomping all over their ability to speak up for our veterans. Unions are even being kicked out of their offices, a direct attempt to silence the voice of VA employees. When VA workers are under attack, veterans pay the price. Costly privatization and outsourcing will run rampant, meaning fewer services and worse quality of care for our nation's heroes. It's time to stand up for the workers who care for our veterans. Paid for by the American Federation of Government Employees.
The United Auto Workers are one of the largest and most diverse unions in North America, with members in virtually every sector of the economy. Learn more about this proud sponsor of our program at UAW.org.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferens with America's Workforce.
And don't forget, you can check us out on 6 platforms now. That includes Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Pandora, and Stitcher. When you get an opportunity, just sign up, receive our shows on a regular basis, and give us a rating. We always like those 5-star ratings. More of those are coming through. Let's go back to our live line, rejoin Bill Samuel on behalf of the AFL-CIO, where he serves as the Government Affairs Director, AFL-CIO.org. All right, a couple things here. We want to bring up voting. Boy, I tell you, I don't like what's going on in the country, especially in these state legislatures. And there is federal legislation that too, much like the infrastructure piece, has been kind of tossed and turned and whittled down. Where are we right now with voting rights legislation on the federal level, Bill?
Well, it is unfortunate that the federal government has to do this, and that Congress needs to insert itself. States are supposed to protect the vote. You know, the laws vary, but they're all supposed to be expanding the franchise, not making it more difficult. But unfortunately, you know, since the last election, at least a dozen, more than that probably, red states have passed laws making it more difficult to vote. I'm cutting back on mail-in ballots, on automatic registration, making it basically more difficult for workers to vote on Election Day. And so the federal government, the Congress, has legislation pending to set a minimum federal standards, so all 50 states would have to comply. And we think it's about time. It's long past time, frankly, that the states open up their voting for every citizen who wants to cast a ballot. Unfortunately, it has fallen victim to the filibuster in the Senate. No Republican has voted for it. That shows you how partisan these state laws are. They want to protect them. They don't want more people to vote. They'd like their voters to vote and nobody else. And so,
right.
The Senate, we hope, will take it up also before the end of the year, along with the budget, and maybe they'll deal with the filibuster. And if they do, that will also be long overdue, because 40 senators, a minority, should not be able to maintain a stranglehold on the agenda that voters approved when they elected this Congress. And so the Freedom to Vote Act and the filibuster are both sort of on the line in December, and we hope they'll take action.
So in order for this legislation to pass, then, you need 60 votes. You got to get 60 votes in the Senate for any kind of progressive voting reform, right?
That's right, unless you change the rules, which it gets complicated here, but you can change it with 51 votes. The rules you don't need 60 votes to change the rules. So if we can get every Democrat and the vice president and the chair, Vice President Harris, we could actually eliminate the 60-vote requirement. There's no law that says 60 votes are required in the Senate. It's basically a Senate rule. It's not in the Constitution.
Okay.
It didn't even exist in the 18th century, in 19th century. It was really a 20th century artifact of the Jim Crow era, when Southern senators would take the floor and they wouldn't stop talking until, the side advancing civil rights legislation gave up, and they said that they passed a rule saying you need a supermajority to cut off debate. We think that time has come and gone, and we ought to get rid of the filibuster, pass the Freedom to Vote Act, pass the Protecting the Right to Organize Act, and do it with a majority, a simple majority, 51 votes.
So what seems to be the problem? Just getting the Democrats on board here? Because from what I've been watching in the media, it seems like the Democrats are their worst enemy right now. They don't have a consensus on this issue, right?
They have a near consensus. I think as of now, there are probably 48 votes to change the Senate rules, to have a real debate and passage with a simple majority. I think they have not finally convinced Joe Manchin, that name keeps coming up, from West Virginia, Democrat, or Kyrsten Sinema, a Democrat from Arizona. They have both said they think the filibuster is a good idea. It forces the two parties to compromise. Unfortunately, it has the opposite effect. It allows one party to just say no, stamp their feet, cross their arms, and say no, and they never have to deal with the consequences. That's kind of Mitch McConnell's calling card, just saying no. Remember, he called the Senate the graveyard of House-passed legislation, proudly, he said that.
Yeah.
If we can convince Senator Manchin and Senator Sinema, we will have the 50 votes we need. We know the vice president would support this rules change. And what I hear from the inside is that they're getting closer to it. They're more open to it because they see the Senate Republicans completely unwilling to compromise, really even to talk about these things like voting rights. And if that's the case, they will change the Senate rules and make it possible to pass the Freedom to Vote Act.
Now, where's Biden on this? Because when he took office, it seemed like he wasn't into the filibuster reform. Has he changed his mind on this?
No, you're right about that. He was in the Senate for 40 years. He's sort of an institutionalist, is how they refer to them. He liked the way it operated when he was there. It's changed since he was there. You know, he left in 2008 to become President Obama's vice president. It's gotten worse. There are more filibusters every year. The Senate is less able to pass legislation with each passing year. And actually, in the last, I'd say, 3-4 months, Vice President Biden has been much more supportive of the idea that the Senate should consider changing its rules, loosening the grip of the minority through the filibuster, and start passing the pieces of his agenda that he really wants to see. And voting rights is one of them. So I think we're going to have the support of President Biden. And that's a big deal, to have someone with his record of having served in the Senate say, you know what, the Senate doesn't work anymore, and we need to change it. And that's pretty much what he's now saying.
Okay. That being said, I'm good with that. We'll see what happens in the next weeks and months ahead. But here's my biggest fear. You know, there's three branches of government. And eventually, okay, let's create a scenario here. let's speculate. We get the votes. We overcome the filibuster. We pass the right kind of voter laws in America that allow people to vote, you know, contrary to what's going on in so many states. And I think it's up to 18 or 19 states right now that have really, really suppressed the vote in America. So we get that all done. Enter the U.S. Supreme Court, which has a 6-3 conservative majority. And you know what they did to the Voting Rights Act a couple of years back, Bill. So with with that scenario I just painted, how do we get this done?
You are absolutely right to be concerned about the Supreme Court. There's no doubt that the minute this, the Freedom to Vote Act passes, or frankly any other progressive legislation, there'll be lawsuits filed by attorneys general from Republican states, from legislators claiming their rights have been trampled on. All I can, you know, try to assure you is that when the Democrats in the House and Senate write these bills, they think they are constitutional in every respect. There's nothing that the Supreme Court can hang its hat on to roll it back. They may end up, you know, maybe they'll be wrong about that, and the Supreme Court will, you know, will make changes when and if these lawsuits get there. But we can't even start this discussion until the House and the Senate passes these bills. The House has already passed them, by the way. Passed both the Freedom to Vote Act, of course, the Protecting the Right to Vote Act, the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act. That's the Restoring the Voting Rights Act. So all these things have passed the House. They're stuck in the Senate because of the filibuster. But you're right to be concerned that, you know, who's on the Supreme Court has a huge significance for what happens when these bills become law, and there will invariably be lawsuits filed.
And I'm thinking about the Voting Rights Act. I mean, that was legislation that passed in 1965, and it was intact for, my gosh, what, over 50 years. And then all of a sudden, a different Supreme Court comes in there. And what, refresh me on that. What did they find wrong with that law that passed in 65?
Well, it was a case called Shelby County. And Shelby County was one of these jurisdictions which was subject to what they call preclearance. When they changed their voting statute because of the history of discrimination under the Civil Rights Act, it had to be cleared by the U.S. Justice Department. So the Justice Department was able to reach in only in certain jurisdictions where there had been a history of discrimination and approve or disapprove voting law changes. The Roberts Court, I think it was 2012, 2013, in the Shelby
Something
County
like
decision
that,
said, that's no longer, it's no longer appropriate to rely on past discrimination going back, you know, decades to give the Justice Department the authority to approve or disapprove. So they ruled that was unconstitutional, and that there went the Voting Rights Act, at least the preclearance provisions. The rest of this, the Voting Rights Act is intact, but there's no teeth. It's like we were speaking about the National Labor Relations Act a minute ago. There are no teeth if the Justice Department can't prevent a jurisdiction from changing its laws. So that the John Lewis bill, Voting Rights Advancement Act, would restore the preclearance provisions to the Civil Rights to the Voting Rights Act.
Well, let's just hope that whatever constitutional scholars we have in the legislature, in the House and the Senate, go over all the details and make sure that this will have enough muster there to pass that 6-3 majority in the U.S. Supreme Court. But, you know, time will tell on that. You know how laws work in America. Well, I'm going to leave it on that note. I just want to say one thing. This has been a tough year for so many people in so many different ways, you know, with the pandemic and in the labor world, the passing of Richard Trumka. And now we have Liz Shuler out in front as president of the AFL-CIO. And I tell you, I've been following Liz and you probably, you know, you obviously work with her closer than people like myself, but on this end, I tell you, it looks like she is doing one heck of a job. She did not miss a beat. Granted, I missed Rich Trumka. I'm sure you do as well, because you worked with him back in the miners' unions days. But I just wanted to make that statement, and I'm sure you're of the same opinion going forward here. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. It has been a transition, obviously, but as you said, Liz has filled the role spectacularly in the last couple of months since President Trump could die in early August, and she's gone a million miles an hour. She's been on picket lines. She's been before Congress. She's been on TV. She's really putting our best foot forward, and I think we're very excited about her leadership. And I think things are looking pretty good right now. With a lot of worker activism, collective activism, strikes that have been successful. So this is, there's reason to be hopeful about the future.
Boy, she is not shy about going on a picket line. No doubt about that. She was recently at the rally for the coal miners still striking at Warrior Met. So, one heck of a fighter. No doubt about that. Yep. All right, buddy. I'm going to let you go back to your Thanksgiving dinner. Enjoy the time with your family, your friends, and all that good stuff. And we'll talk in December, okay?
Thanks very much.
Bill Samuel, Government Affairs Director of the AFL-CIO. We're going to take a quick break. Lucas Franco on behalf of LIUNA in the Midwest. We're talking Minnesota, North Dakota. He's coming up next.
This is America's Workforce. More shows available at awfradio.com.
It takes LIUNA to keep America running. Over 70,000 public employees are part of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, delivering critical services such as healthcare and emergency response, as well as maintaining roads and sanitation systems. Even the National Postal Mail Handlers Union, representing over 47,000 U.S. postal workers, is affiliated with LIUNA. Find out what it takes for LIUNA to keep America running at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
There is unity and strength for workers.
We are the USW.
We are the USW.
The United Steelworkers.
The largest industrial union in North America.
We represent 850,000 members in the U.S., Canada, and the Caribbean.
We work in metals,
rubber,
chemicals,
paper,
oil refining,
atomic energy,
and the service sector.
We are steelworkers, standing strong and fighting for what's right.
America's Workforce is sponsored in part by Boyd Watterson Asset Management, LLC. Find out more about our investment solutions tailored to meet the needs of Taft-Hartley funds at BoydWatterson.com.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And don't forget, you can check us out on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Twitter handle, real simple, AWF Union Podcast. AWF Union Podcast. By the way, this next segment brought to you in part by the Ohio Federation of Teachers. You can find more at oh.aft.org. Let's go to line number two now, and welcome back to the show. It's been a while since we had him on. Lucas Franco is his name. Lucas is the regional research manager for the Minnesota and North Dakota chapter of LIUNA. We're talking about the Laborers International Union of North America, presenting sponsor of this show. We call America's Workforce. LIUNA is a building trades union representing 13,000 members across those two states and a little part of Wisconsin. Across the country, we're talking over 550,000 strong. Lucas Franco, how we doing today, brother?
Doing well. It's great to be back. Thanks for having me on.
And how's that little one? Last time we talked, you had a baby on the way. Everything okay?
That's right. Just a little sleep deprived, but everything is going well. Systems are all working, so that's good.
That's good. Keeping you on your toes. Well, Lucas, I want to thank you for the information that you forwarded me regarding wage theft. This is an issue that has just been a hotbed of controversy for the trucking industry and certainly for the building trades. And you did a lot of research on this. Let's talk about what's happening in your area in Minnesota and North Dakota. What's the story there?
That's right. I think you put it well that this is an issue that happens throughout our economy and in every industry. It's a growing problem. And, for years, we had workers coming to us, non-union workers, talking about all the different ways in which they were getting cheated out of their wages, whether it was being misclassified, whether they were just not being paid what they were promised. We knew it was a really big problem, but didn't have a sort of quantifiable understanding of the scale. And thankfully, Frank Manzo and his team at the Midwest Economic Policy Institute put out a report earlier this year that showed the full scale of the problem. And what they found was really shocking, actually. They estimated that about 1 in 4 Minnesota construction workers are victims of wage theft. And I mean, that's just stunning to think 1 in 4 have experienced wage theft. And that's about 30,000 construction workers per year. And it's not just, you know, that workers are, that it's morally wrong and that workers are losing what they've been promised and being cheated. That's bad enough, but it also impacts entire communities. You know, we're losing huge amounts of tax revenue from employers that aren't paying their workers fairly. I think the report estimated that Minnesota loses about $136 million in state revenues due to construction payroll tax fraud. So that's a huge amount of money. And then, of course, the last component is that contractors that are trying to play by the rules, that want to do the right thing, pay workers fairly, they're just consistently being undercut by those contractors that constantly cheat and steal wages and don't pay their workers fairly. So it's a really, really big problem, and we're doing everything we can to try to address it.
And so should a state like Minnesota. I mean, if you're losing $136 million in state tax revenues and $65 million in income taxes, $13 million in unemployment insurance contributions, you would think that they would be a bit more aggressive in tackling this problem. What do we know about that right now, Lucas?
That's right. I mean, you're spot on. And I think the state has been trying to do a lot. So we actually, a couple years ago in 2019, passed one of the nation's strongest wage theft acts that really seeks to address wage theft kind of on the back end, so that it gives more resources to the Department of Labor and Industry and the Attorney General's office, makes wage theft a felony. So, you know, creates new tools in the toolkit of the state and state regulators to punish wage theft. But all they can really do, I think, is sort of scratch the surface. What we're really trying to do is get on the prevention side to make sure that the same bad players aren't showing up in city after city and building new projects, you know, that there's some public visibility, that workers that see something have an avenue to say something, to raise concerns, and mm-hmm. that cities, that municipalities are on the front line to try to hold developers, general contractors, subcontractors accountable. So, you know, what we've really focused on is, yes, we've got some good new tools in the toolkit around sort of punishment on the back end when wage theft occurs, but that's not nearly enough. So we're focused on the prevention side and doing a lot of work on that side of things.
I see you have a website up, buildbettermn.org. That's the website you want to go to, buildbettermn, short for Minnesota, buildbettermn.org, which is meant to provide a landing page for information about the scale of the wage theft problem. And I'll touch on that at the end of the interview. But if you'd be so kind, give me a couple of quick examples here of how workers are being ripped off. And you did a lot of homework on this. And I'll tell you, Lucas, this needs to be said on the air. People need to know how they're being ripped off. And sometimes they don't even know they're being ripped off. So you got a couple of examples here. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's right. And I think because it happens and wage theft occurs in so many different ways, it is really valuable to understand all the different ways and that workers are getting screwed and cheated out of their wages. So examples and cases, I think, are incredibly helpful, especially for workers to be able to understand that they're not being treated fairly. So just a few examples from recent years. You know, one of the most kind of troubling examples is from about a mile from where I live, and the wake of the murder of George Floyd, you know, we had these massive uprisings in Minneapolis. A lot of buildings were burned, including a mall right near the Third Precinct, which was the police station that was sort of at the epicenter of all the activity. So this mall was heavily damaged. The mall owners brought in a demo company owned by a private equity group, which is increasingly common these days for private equity to play a big role in some of these demo companies. Demo company came in, brought a bunch of workers up from Chicago. Now these workers are saying that they weren't being paid fairly. They weren't being paid minimum wage for the city. There were all kinds of illegal deductions for their travel arrangements and other things. And the company wasn't providing them with timesheets, so they have no real way to show how they're being cheated. And so there's a class action lawsuit around that case, and also the city of Minneapolis is investigating. And this is a national demo company that sweeps in the wake of natural disasters, whether that's Hurricane Katrina or whether that's civil uprisings. So that's one example. Another example is from a masonry company. Actually, we had an action a couple days ago to try to highlight the issues with this particular subcontractor. And it's kind of a unique and interesting case. Well, it's not that unique, but it's certainly an interesting case in that this company, Wisconsin-based masonry company, relies incredibly heavily on the H-2B visa program, which is the guest worker program. So they're bringing up workers from Mexico, Honduras, et cetera, and they're supposed to pay prevailing wages based on the type of work that these workers are doing. So if you're doing concrete work, you're supposed to be paying the area prevailing wage for that concrete work. And what we found is that workers have alleged with this company that they're systematically being misclassified, so that we found many cases where they should be making $25-26 an hour. Instead, they're making $18 an hour. And so it's this kind of wage theft where they're losing $8 an hour. And in the case of the H-2B program, these workers are borderline indentured servants. Their entire visa is tied to a particular employer. And so good luck, trying to speak up and raise concerns, because they're going to have a real hard time getting that visa restored the next year, or they might even be sent home in the short term. So it's this incredibly disturbing power arrangement where the employer holds all the power. And we've seen a rise of this H-2B program, and it's really troubling. And this case is one illustration of how it can play out and be quite exploitative. So those are two examples, and there's just so many. We encounter different examples almost daily in talking to workers, from misclassification, use of independent contracting, to just straight stealing wages, not paying workers what an employer has promised.
Lucas, I did the math on what you just told me about the $8 an hour that the workers are being screwed out. That comes out to $64 a day, $320 a week. So 52 weeks, you're looking at $16,000 a year. $16,000 a year. They're getting screwed. Yeah.
Stunning.
Yeah. That's what's happening right now as we speak. There's one more I want to get into, and apparently this guy, Ricardo, is it Batras, ran a staffing agency in Minnesota? What's that story about?
Yeah, so Ricardo Batras, I'm glad you brought that up. He ran a construction worker staffing agency, so he would supply, I think, often framing work, some drywall work. He'd staff up different projects in the Twin Cities metro with workers, and he was found guilty of human trafficking in Hennepin County. And what the case and the, what was ultimately found in the case and in the sentencing is that he was coercing undocumented laborers to work for his construction company under dangerous conditions that led to permanent injuries. And then what his victim said in court during the sentencing was that when they tried to speak up or raise concerns, that he would often use, threaten them with deportation or reporting them to ICE, things like that, where, it's sort of leveraging their immigration status to try to silence them, to keep them quiet. And that's what was found in court and in the sentencing and what workers allege. And I think that's extremely common. What is often the case is that a lot of workers in the construction industry that are victims of wage theft are immigrant workers, sometimes, you know, undocumented workers, sometimes not, but always vulnerable. And, you know, many employers, I think what we've seen is take advantage of being these folks being new to the country, being vulnerable, and exploit that. And it's really tragic, unfair, and we're doing everything we can to try to prevent that.
And I know you're doing a lot. One of the things which we touched on already is the Not On Our Watch campaign to highlight the cases that we're talking about. Again, that website is buildbettermn.org. I also see you're working with a couple of other building trades unions, the Carpenters Union, and a local worker center. How's that going so far for you?
That's right. It's going really well. It's, you know, to be able to work in a coalition and to share ideas, share resources, and work together is incredibly valuable, and it's how we can actually change this industry. We can't do it alone. We need to work as a team. And our little team going here in Minnesota around wage theft is going well. It's effective and really great to work with this worker center, Satool, just because they, you know, are more plugged into the residential construction industry. They just have a lot of trust in the immigrant Latino community. And so bringing in their insights, their connections, their trust in the community provides an avenue to help many workers that might not otherwise speak up or might not know who to talk to speak up. So saying all that, that's right. We have this buildbetter.mn, buildbettermn.org website, and we have this Not On Our Watch campaign that's focused on highlighting cases of exploitation and then really trying to empower workers in general, but particularly our members, to say something when they see something, because, you know, they are the ones that are working on construction sites. They're talking to non-union workers that might be getting exploited. You know, they hear all sorts of stories about these different forms of wage theft, and we want to provide an avenue for them to bring those concerns to us so that we can help do something about it. So we've got that campaign, which is going well, and we're trying to sort of bolster and bring more folks into it. We're also doing more public actions. We had an action 2 days ago off I-94. It was a frigid November morning here in Minnesota, and it was nice to be out there. We had a banner up. We were handing out flyers, and we were in front of a project where we had serious concerns about possible wage theft. So just out visibly trying to educate the public. And then the last thing we're doing is putting a lot of energy into engaging municipalities. So trying to give small cities that approve a lot of multifamily housing projects, which is the sector of the industry where we see some of the worst wage theft, trying to empower them with some tools to make sure that this criminal wage theft isn't happening in their community. So we've been meeting with, we've sort of been on an educational blitz, meeting with a lot of these small cities and towns to give them some tools to help around wage theft prevention. So I have a meeting coming up in a couple hours with a city here in the Twin Cities Metro doing just that, trying to give them some wage theft prevention tools, so that we get on the front end and prevent this wage theft from happening upstream.
Very good. Sounds like you're doing a really good campaign over there in Minnesota. Again, the website is buildbettermn.org. Not On Our Watch campaign. You see something going wrong, talk about it. Get activated. Educate the community. And that's exactly what LIUNA members in Minnesota and North Dakota are doing. Lucas Franco, I thank you so much. You can get more at liunaminnesota.org. They're also on Facebook, LIUNA Minnesota, at LIUNA Minnesota is their Twitter handle as well. You take care. The best of the holiday season to you and all the brothers and sisters of LIUNA. Okay, my buddy?
Thanks to you. Thanks to you, brother. Same to you. You have a great one.
All right, that's it for another edition of America's Workforce. Coming up tomorrow, the latest from Working Class Perspectives and the United Steelworkers. Until then, all of you, have a safe and wonderful day.
That concludes another episode of the America's Workforce Radio podcast. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe so you never miss a show. America's Workforce is a production of Labor Tools and BMA Media Group. Find out more information online at labortools.com.